session number 27074, reel 15.
Squadron Leader Van Bamberger, reel 15.
Whilst in Sicily, I was transferred from 93 Squadron to 243 Squadron as a flight commander. And I recollect it. We were not too busy, for we actually did some practice and training, only formation flying and that sort of thing, but we had time to pull my new squadron I joined together, and as it was quiet and comparatively peaceful, we started to get some discipline back into the squadron, which had obviously been lost in North Africa. Someone called Rosie Mackey, a well-known Australian or bleak New Zealand pilot, was the CO. He was a very outgoing extrovert character, but I got on with him reasonably well. Then he was involved in something which annoyed the AOC Broadhurst, because Rosie had obtained a Mercedes Benz, and I think probably Broadhurst wanted it. So Rosie Mackey disappeared. And a South African pilot, Shorty Langham, a South African Air Force pilot, became the new CO.
Did the Australians and South Africans and New Zealanders, was their outlook any different from RAF pilots in the way that they did things? Or were they, did you all mix together?
Well, 243 Squadron, by the time we were ready for the invasion, covering the invasion on the Salerno beaches, was a very mixed bunch of New Zealand, Canadian, Australians, South Africans. In fact, we had three South Africans. And the reason being was that the South Africans had basically all been in the desert. Now they were all surplus. And that is why I think, for instance, Shorty Langman was made CO of the squadron, because there was they didn't know what to do with them. But, I mean, they were very likeable people, and I got on with them very well. Shorty Langman, I'm saying anything against him, but of course he had nothing like my experience. And I wouldn't say he was a highly intelligent man. I don't mean I had to advise him or instruct him, but nevertheless, I could never quite look upon him as my CO, as I had so much more experience than he had.
I was thinking on their outlook, are they a little less prone to, say, the RAF discipline as you've described earlier in the war? Would they be much more open, or much more, I don't know how to describe it really, but would they have a different outlook?
No, I think the South Africans were almost, even if they were what I call a Boer extraction, they were sort of just as British as the British. The Canadians and the Australians tended to be, particularly the Australians, tended to be a bit wilder, which in some instances was good, in others was bad.
You said that discipline had needed to be pulled together a little bit. What had happened with discipline in North Africa and during the Sicilian campaign?
When a squadron, almost in any stage of operations, is under stress and flying, and remember, normally you were living and eating under difficult conditions, so things ease off. You've got to ease it off because of the just of the personal circumstances. You know, you couldn't complain about dress because you probably hadn't the opportunity to have a clean shirt or anything like that, and you know probably they'd had a rotten meal before they'd taken off, and so, you know, in that respect, things slacken off generally. And so there we were in Sicily with what I called time to splur. And you looked around this scruffy lot and thought, you know, one should make them a bit more shipshape.
Where were you based on Sicily?
I cannot reckon. We had two bases in southern Sicily, but then we moved up to northern Sicily prior preparing for the invasion. But I cannot remember the names of the bases now. But it was northern Sicily.
So discipline had been tightened and you'd done some formation training.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
What was your proposed role for the invasion of the Italian mainland?
Well, we were briefed very well about the landing, and we had maps gridded showing where the various sort of forces were and where they would be landing and where the airstrips would be made when we landed, because that was a big job, preparing airstrips quickly. And it was quite a long flight to Salerno, for Salerno beachhead, from northern Sicily. So that is the first time we flew with 90-gallon overload tanks. And we'd never used them before. And so by dawn of D-Day, we had to be over the Salerno beaches. I think on the first sortie, the only fire we got was from the Navy, who fired at anything that flew, just in case it may have been the opposition. I think it was something like there was, while we were patrolling, while we were doing the cover from operating from Sicily, you were a long way from home, and the return journey was mostly over the sea. There was very little interference by the German Air Force. I think the only ones we came across were 109s carrying bombs, were trying to bomb the various vessels that were landing troops. But if a 109 had come down from height, dropping a bomb, and then went out at speed, you hadn't a hope of catching it. So you were there more as a deterrent, that they knew you were there. To my knowledge, they didn't send, in daylight hours, any actual bombers. On somewhere around about day 3 or 4, we were told we were going to land on an airstrip, which we did. We were then told it was the wrong one. We took off and landed another airstrip. we landed on one which the Americans wanted or had been allocated. So we landed this airstrip, and when you land there, of course, certain things have gone on ahead of you, and you hope there's some tents, and you dig a ditch to hide in if there's any bombing going on, and you hope it doesn't rain too much, because in Italy, and again I can't remember the time of the year, when it rains, it really rains, downpours. And you dug a trench round your tent so the water wouldn't run into the tent, or hopefully it wouldn't, but the trenches soon filled up and the water then ran into the tent. forgetting the personal details of washing, hygiene, feeding, which was pretty rough. The thing I always remember at night, I don't think you see, you could see the shells from the Germans firing at the shipping, and the shipping firing at the Germans, and you could actually watch them going over at night. You actually see them. It was, and we were just sitting in the middle of these gunnery battles that went on.
How close were you to the front line?
I should say about 3 or 4 miles. Because at one time, I remember they were mortaring us. The Germans were firing mortar trying to get our aircraft. So it was fairly close at one stage. You'd have to look at history books, but there was the American 5th Air Force, 5th Army, and the British, I don't know, it was 8th Army, I think it was called, and the Germans attacked between the two, and they got very, very close to the beachhead. And so probably it was about that time when they were mortaring us. But again, it's a long time ago, and I can't remember all the details.
Was that to allow you to operate over the beachhead for longer periods?
Oh, yes. You could take off, and you could patrol the beachhead with a long-range tank on for almost forever. Certainly 2.5 hours or something like that, you see.
How did these long-range tanks work? Because you said you'd never used them before.
Well, you didn't really worry about them in the initial stages because you had the extra fuel and it was very advantageous. But when the army started breaking out of the beachhead and you had more breathing space and you were then trying to perform some other operation apart from just defending the beachhead, if you went into a serious attack, the only thing to do was to jettison the long-range tanks because they would come some heavy interfere, and also if something hit the long-range tank, I mean, that was you'd go up with it. So once you were involved in combat, which there wasn't much at that time, you jettison the long-range tank. We spoke about, when we touched on North Africa, about ground staffing and Spitfires not really being... Well, I remember on one occasion, I was asked to air test a Spitfire, probably had a new engine put in or something, and I took off to air test it, and I saw in the not too distant, I mean, it may have been 8 miles away, some German vehicles moving. And I thought, well, I'm up here air testing, I might as well air test my guns as well. And it was a group of tankers and lorries, and the lorries were obviously full of fuel, and the tank, the lorries had fuel aboard. And that was the first time again that I'd seen people being involved in war. It's not like a soldier, you know, because I attacked these and sent, I can't remember now, possibly one or two vehicles on fire, and I saw people on fire. And anyway, that was it. I came back, obviously reported what I'd done, and it caused some excitement. So that everybody then wanted to go off and air test guns. And I'm sure it was about that time someone said no, no more strafing and Spitfires.
With these long-range tanks, would you use the fuel in them first, or would you use the aircraft fuel and then take it from the tank afterwards?
I'm certain we use the fuel from the tank first. we must use the fuel from the tank first.
How would you jettison it? How do you do that?
Well, you just had a lever to pull, but I cannot remember exactly what it was like.
The reason behind obviously stopping the strafing was that purely the vulnerability of the Spitfire?
Well, the Spitfire was too valuable to risk that sort of activity at that time.
So you
I can take it a little stage further while we're just on this subject, but probably won't come back to it again. I remember one time being briefed, because I frequently was leading the squadron then, to do a sweep over a particular area, because intelligence said that there was likely to be a big movement of German aircraft. Unfortunately, the intelligence was wrong, or the Germans didn't do what they said they were going to do on their radio communications. And so coming out from this, that I said, you know, let's go down. I felt my instruction would be, I'm going down, and the squadron all followed me. And one of my pilot shouted up that he saw something, I'll say a train, I can't remember now. And I said, okay, go down and attack. I wasn't going to take the whole squadron down, you know, it just did. And cut a long short, he was shot down. That evening, I was having my meal or something, when I was told the wing commander flying, Phil Tony Lovell, wanted to see me. And as I was leading the squadron at the time, I don't know what he wanted to say to me, but obviously give me some instructions. All he wanted me was to... He blasted me to hell for losing a pilot on such a sort of a... In other words, do what you're supposed to do. So he was keeping me under control, that's all. He's probably doing a good job.
How easy was it to identify targets on the ground at the speed
of... Oh, no, not easy at all. Not easy. I mean, it was difficult, different from then, say, on D-Day, when sort of, you know, you had specific things that you were going to do, going for trains or armoured cars or whatever. Mark, you're moving over the ground fairly fast. You've got to be low to see these things. And but once you saw your targets, you never saw them and then just went down on them. You almost certainly had to then go around to attack them. You sort of, it wasn't. So, there we are. Anyway.
So, generally, you would actually make an assessment of the situation before you wouldn't go straight into attack, not knowing.
Yes, I just kind of one little bit. I remember once going into attack. Must have been a group of vehicles, I think. And the fire that came up was tremendous. But it wasn't the fire that put me off so much, because I called off the attack from the whole squadron. I said, no, you know, break away. Because there was red crosses over everything. And that's why I mainly called it off, not by fire. But because of the intensity of the fire, I'm sure they were not red, they were bogus red crosses. But the two things combined made me, it wasn't worth risking aircraft with that intensity of fire. But the red crosses were definitely phony. And during that period of time, that was confirmed on a number of occasions, the German using red crosses.
What was the German opposition like, aerial opposition like during this period?
Hardly any at all. Again, remember, I'm always comparing it with the past. I mean, day after day would go past and you wouldn't see anything, and occasionally you would find something to shoot at. In fact, you could say during the Salerno, covering the Salerno landings and the advance onto Naples, the German opposition was virtually non-existent. Aerial opposition was virtually non-existent. And so, but you always had to be prepared. You know, you can never just relax and say, oh, well, they're not around. But I remember from by that time, we now moved on to Capitacino Airport, which was, had been a real airfield at Naples, and we'd landed there. And the army were already in there and taken over all the best accommodation. And a very exclusive, used to be a mounted regiment, somebody, dragoons or something, had taken over this big building close to the airport. And they didn't need it all. So we decided that the 324 wing needed some of it. But the amusing part about it, anyway, so we got quite good, you know, accommodation. Obviously, we just had our camp beds and things, but anyway, it was a good solid roof over your head and sort of the like. And the army put up with us. They found us, I think, a bit scruffy, but they put up with us. But the interesting story of that, these very select gentlemen had gone into this place, and it was a mental hospital. And they'd turfed everybody out into Naples. The ladies would come up to this building offering their services, mainly for soap. So it's amazing where you can get your laundry done and soap and other services that you require them. But while we were there at Capitacino, I tell you, it was quiet. I remember the Sheep Gilroy, who was our group captain, coming up to me one day and saying, Bab, let's go and have a look at the war. No, let's have a go and look at Rome. That's right. So the two of us flew from Raybould's up north to Rome, just the two of us, and we didn't see anything, we weren't attacked by anything, and we just, so I saw Rome and they didn't die.
Was there any anti-aircraft fire at all?
There may have been, I went to tell you, obviously we weren't risking anything, we were just sort of, sometimes with just two of you, you're safer than if there's a group of you, you know. Because you can't move if there's a group of you. Two of us just flying, you know, sort of.
Were you surprised by this lack of German opposition, really?
Well, I was, because at the time I was trying to become an air ace. It was really, it was a bit frustrating not having anyone to attack, actually. I think only on occasionally with the odd skirmish, a plot would be reported of something and you'd chase it or, you know, it came to nothing. Or, well, I'd have to get my log word and I'd check, and it's not worth boring you with. But I remember one tangle with quite a bunch of 109s. Now, how they happened to be in the area and what they were doing, I think they were lost. But because there were so many of them, we must have been a squadron of ours, 12 hours. Everything went all over the air, as they do, a bit like in the Battle of Britain, and so virtually everything disappeared, and I chased one who was heading north, and you chased him, and, you know, they were, for speed, the one I was at that time were probably a little faster than the 5Bs we had, so the chance of catching him was nil, so turned back and went home and claimed one frightened.
How did you affect your moves from one airfield or airstrip to another?
Fortunately, being a flight commander or CO or, you know, whatever time, I always flew. But the surplus pilots went by lorry, and all our ground crew went by lorry and so forth. And it was a big logistic thing. It was not... I'm going to talk about logistics now, but it happened somewhat later. But I'll mention it now, it's rather the subject, we don't have to come back to it. I remember once watching our ground crew loading up lorries, because we were going to move from one airfield to another. And I suddenly realised that over X period, the ground crew had gathered a lot of what are called luxuries, like mattresses and such like, which, you know, I would say they were looted, but, you know, they'd been picked up on the way. And I've seen these lorries, instead of being filled with vital equipment, I would say they were luxury beds. There were all sorts of things going on. And I had, very sadly, just to tell them to throw them into the side of the road and put on the lorries what was supposed to be going on the lorries.
Would you, when you flew, would you take little bits of your kit with you?
We normally took basics, because in the Spitfire there wasn't much room, but you'd stick basics with you. You know, shaving gear. But, I mean, I'm never really reflecting on it until you answer the question now. But, I mean, we were probably, from time to time, a very scruffy, dirty lot. Because, certainly in North Africa and certain other places, even, you know, in Sicily and Italy, no, water was always in short supply. Or what I call drinkable water was always in short supply. And it was a matter of whether you washed in it, drank in it, or did your laundry in it.